You are listening to Fantha Tracks.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
It's not true. That's impossible.
Hello and welcome to episode 175 of Making Tracks, brought to you by those fine folk over at fanfortracks.com. My name's Mark. Joining me this week, as always, is the head honcho of Fanfortracks. It's Mr. Mark Newbold. Marky boy, how are you doing? How's things?
You can't see me, but I've got a big grin on my face because I've been looking forward to talking to you for ages. So I'm glad we're doing it again. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, my friend. Yeah, very well. It has been a while. So it's been a good couple of weeks, which I think this has been the longest gap that we've had since I started recording, since records began. Yeah. So it's been a while, but we're back to a more regular pattern of releases, as it were. So, you know, we've eaten enough fiber, so we should be regular. So it's all good. So what have you been up to for the last couple of weeks?
Well, I've had a busy couple of weeks because New York Comic Con was last weekend. So myself and Matt and Brian went over to New York for Comic Con. But before that, we were fortunate enough, especially for me, because I was only there about a month ago, got back to Florida for a couple of days. Brian had never done Galaxy's Edge, so we went to Florida for 3 days, flew up to New York and did Comic-Con for 4 days and then came back. So the weather was lovely in Florida. The weather wasn't too bad in New York, to be fair. Comic-Con's always fun. We've been piling stuff onto the site this week from booths and stuff that was on the show floor. We've had a couple of Cannon Fodder episodes out with the two Star Wars panels that were there. And it's always good at Comic-Con. If you're not having a good time at Comic-Con, especially New York Comic Con, you're doing it wrong. So we certainly had a good time. We did Mos Eisley on the Saturday, which was fantastic fun. I'm knackered. I mean, I came back like a fool. I did some work on the way home from the airport, which was not clever, and then pretty much zoned out on the Tuesday, and then went back to work on the Wednesday, and I've been kind of like a zombie ever since. How about you, mate?
Busy with work, the run-up to Christmas, so suddenly things seem to all need to get finished and delivered pretty pronto, which is kind of good for employment, bad for the work-life balance and stuff. But other than that, all good. In terms of like collection, I've had a lovely brand spanking new, although it doesn't look it, Mandalorian N1 Starfighter.
Oh, you know, the Hasbro one.
Yeah, the Hasbro one. So that's turned up.
Nice.
Yes, very happy about it. I mean, obviously, being a mint in box collector, I cannot confirm whether or not everything is all there or is missing and stuff like that. And I know some people have had some issues with bears that come out of a box, but as I will never take out of a box, I am blissfully unaware. Also, from Hasbro, the dual pack of Ewok figures.
Oh, wow, yes.
Are they Black Series? Or they? No, they're Vintage Collection. Vintage, I'm going to have to check. Yeah.
I need to get them. I saw them at Comic-Con. I didn't know they were coming. I saw them on the shelf. I was like, what on earth are they? Are they fan-made? What are they? Booker said, no, they're coming out. I need to get them. I totally need to get them.
Yeah, obviously they're carded as they were back in the day, but they kind of come in this nice kind of collector's box as well, so you kind of have them both together, which is a nice. One thing I did get, which is very nice, I've got a couple of beautiful prints from Bowman's Green. So they are the like the new kind of Star Wars Weekly ones. As a special extra thank you, he also sent me a Zippo lighter, which you kind of go, oh, that's really random. Now, the Zippo lighter was given to cast and crew on a short TV production called Fleming, which was all about Ian Fleming, which was shot about 10 years ago. And actually inscribed on the Zippo lighter is Fleming. So it's I've got that now in my James Bond collection. So yeah, thank you very much to Simon for that, because that was cool. So been fairly good. How about yourself?
I didn't go crazy at Disney because we were limited on luggage space and luggage weight from flying from Florida to New York. So I didn't buy an awful lot there, just little knickknacks, really. We went into a Five Below and they'd got loads of little weird little Grogu bits. And then New York got the Hallmark exclusive. So it was the Cassantan, Funko Boba Fett, and I think it was Darth Revan, if I remember. They did a Dark Droids issue 1, New York Comic Con exclusive with Ahsoka on the cover, which was really sweet. So I picked up that. Usually always pick up little knick-knacky bits. So there's lots of little fiddly farty bits. You know me and my fiddly farty bits. All that sort of stuff. Mos Eisley was brilliant. As I say, Roosevelt's were one of the sort of sponsors behind that, as were Culture Fly. So you got a big box of Culture Fly stuff and a T-shirt in there. And then Roosevelt's did like an exclusive shirt for the event. So it's always the same with me. I like all the little fiddly stuff. Oh, very briefly met Brendan Wayne. We were
nice.
Yeah, we were hoping to do an interview and it never quite worked out. We were never free when he was free. We're going to try and sort something out in between. He asked us when we went to his table, he goes, well, which one are you guys? Any of you guys into soccer? He said, soccer. I am. And he got a picture of himself holding a football. So he just signed it BW. He went, well, that's for you. So I've got a Brendan Wayne, not cast and crew, but kind of, you know, his sticker. With not his signature, but just BW on it, which is enough for me. So well, I'm happy with that. Yeah. That was very cool. Lots of comics. There's still bits to review. I'm looking around behind me now. Oh, hang on. It was the From a Certain Point of View book. Because there was a few authors there, I'm just opening the page now, and I won't be able to recognise any of their scribbles. No, I can't recognise any of their scribbles, but let me look through who was there. So Charles Soule was there, Lisa Wong was there.
Cool.
A couple of other guys were there. So we've got a lot of nice autographs on there, which was very, very sweet. And then also on his table, on Charles Soule's table, he had the Barnes & Noble exclusive version of Tales of Light and Life. Claudia Gray signed it. Charles Soule signed it. Alyssa Wong signed it. I saw Zoraida Cordova. She literally walked into the convention centre and I think I was pretty much the first person she saw and didn't get her to sign it because I never saw her again. Just a few signed books, which was very nice. So it's been a good couple of weeks.
Excellent. Sounds like you've been busy.
I have been busy.
How about the news?
I think we should start talking about stuff because it has been a couple of weeks since we've talked about anything. Galactic Star Cruiser. It's recently closed. I was very fortunate to have got on one of the last cruises. And as you know, and anybody who listens to Fantha knows, I really enjoyed it. It's gone. There's no official word on it coming back. But there was a survey sent out to non-journalists and non-bloggers and influencers, just to regular folks who happened to be lucky enough to do the Star Cruiser. Some of them were sent a questionnaire asking them what they thought of the experience, a variety of questions detailing what they thought of it, so on and so forth. Not many people have seen this survey, but it's out there. And I think the big point is that it appears, at least at the moment, Lucasfilm and Disney are considering some kind of future for the Star Cruiser because the building is still there. They've not leveled it like I think a lot of us thought they might. They're not doing that. They've basically dust covered it, which thankfully is a good thing because it would be literally criminal if they flattened that thing. I know you've not done it, but you've probably seen a lot of the news and the sort of the discourse on Galactic Star Cruiser. Do you think they, one, could, two, should bring it back? And if so, what sort of format would you think would be a good way to bring this thing back?
For the fact I didn't get a chance to do it, I would definitely say bring it back. Not only has there been a survey, I think in some of the fan groups and stuff, there's been like a petition or something kind of going around to save the Halcyon. The thing is, I don't necessarily think 1 year was really long enough to kind of say this is a success or failure. The big thing, I think, has always been the price point. And maybe that's where they need to address that. Having not done it, I don't necessarily know what the repeatability is. Now, interestingly, Justin Sonfeld, who is the Legion Commanding Officer of 501st, went a lot, and a fantastic family who are all Star Wars fans. So therefore, the enthusiasm to go back, and I guess, I mean, I think his son is kind of like at the right age where I think they're going to get the most out of it, you know, from a family perspective. Maybe it's a case of they even need to just lower the price. Maybe it's the case of they offer access for day trips, you know, so you can obviously stay. You can just come for the day and leave and go back home or what have you, without obviously knowing the ins and outs of it, and maybe like what the pressure was from either the shareholders or other people in Disney to kind of like really close it. I feel like it's a little bit short-sighted to have kind of closed it as quickly as it did. I mean, it was always meant to be a bit of an experiment, really, wasn't it? It was always kind of meant to be something that they were going to suck and see, but surely there's got enough data, and they will get enough data from the census to be able to even make an informed decision based on what they do with it going forward, or use the experience about how they create other experiences for guests in other different areas and use that. And I'm sure they will. I mean, if there's a chance to kind of kick it back open, I think they probably should.
It's interesting you mentioned Justin. I was with Justin last week. Roosevelt's had an event before Mos Eisley on the Saturday, and Justin was there with his wife, Naomi, and a whole bunch of other people who'd done the Star Cruiser and who wonderfully knew who Fanthatrax were, which was very nice. but I had a really good chat with Justin about not just the Star Cruiser, but fandom in general and just positive vibes and positive. He's a very upbeat guy. him and other people had said, you know, the thought processes of, well, how would you bring it back? And one of the ideas out there is that maybe they open it up for so many hours a day, two or three groups of however many people could go in and pay, I don't know, a couple of $100 to go in and be on the Star Cruiser, see the end experience, the big sort of finale experience, go around the ship, maybe have a bite to eat. And then during the week, they could still do a couple of cruises, because if they bring it back, the interest would be there. I think it's kind of what you sort of said. It's the sustainability of it is how do you keep that interest up? There's four sections: pre-arrival, on board, in your room, and overall. So it's looking at all the different parts, moments that shape the experience, the trip you do down to Batuu when you're actually in Galaxy's Edge, and dinner taste around the galaxy, the food that you have. So there's lots of different parts of it that constitutes the whole experience, and they all need to be working. And in my view, they were. But I think personally that you wouldn't go far wrong by doing something along the lines of what they do. And it's not the same because it's a fixed exhibit. But the Potter Tour down in Leavesden near Watford, where they have seasons, you could literally go four times a year, 3 months apart.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff is fairly fixed, but they do have a different vibe and a different tone and a different feel. And it's different enough that we go every year. So we went in January. When we go next year, we might probably go later in the summer to get a different feel. If they did something like that, if you went on the house in, let's face it, a vehicle that's supposed to have been out there for 275 years flying around, you go and do it and it's the sequel trilogy era with Rey and Kylo, but maybe you do it again and it's the Clone Wars era, so you've got Asajj Ventress and Anakin fighting on the bridge, or you do it during the Galactic Civil War and it's Luke and Vader fighting on the bridge. They could change it. The fixtures and the fittings of the ship don't need to change. They are what they are. This ship is its own thing. So I think if they could loosen it up in terms of the chronology and the timing and things like that, you're going to get out of Batuu and it's a sequel trilogy era Batuu. Fine. I think if they can just step away from needing it to be quite so tight on that timeline, I think they would interest people. You mentioned Justin again. He's been a few times, and some people we were on the tour with had done it 5, 6, 7 times. I got really friendly with a lady called Jen, and she did it 2 times in a row. When we went on the Sunday, she'd just got off the last cruise the previous day. So some people have the means to do that, but not everybody does. But if you know that you can go in October next year, and in from October to March, it's original trilogy time period, that's going to attract a lot of people. So I think if they could tweak it in that respect, it would work, because all the other elements, the food's phenomenal, or the merchandise in there so clever and it's unique to the ship. I think they've got options, I really do.
Even if they were to do it Thursday through to Sunday or something like that each week. And there's peak time. So like during the peak, say summer, that's when you have it open all 7 days. But then when the kids go back to school and stuff, you kind of quieten it down. Or you do what you said. I mean, and this is what people have said even about Galaxy's Edge, is that maybe they need to rotate the eras a little bit, because obviously to really capture like the excitement of all the guests, not every guest is that familiar with the sequel trilogy. It's not been around as long as the OT. And let's be fair, everybody wants to see Darth Vader and some stormtroopers and that, you know, so there's going to be some who would probably do that. I mean, I've been to the Harry Potter thing 3, maybe 4 times over like years, and I've been once at Christmas, once at Halloween, which was special, and also just during in a regular year. And I spent Christmas Day actually at Euro Disney a few years back, and, you know, just obviously spending any kind of festive period, like be it Halloween or Christmas at Disney, they do really well, be it in Florida or Paris. They maybe need to think about being a little bit more flexible with that kind of stuff.
If they open their calendars as far out as they can, for example, peak times, you want to give as many people as possible the option to at least be on that ship, to have experienced it, gone on the shuttle and walked through the doors into the main atrium, or looking to the bridge and jump to hyperspace. And the more Star Wars fans do that, the more likely you are to get people go, it's expensive, yeah, but I could spend 3 days in this place. And work towards maybe not next year, but maybe the year after they come back as a family and do it. It would tee people up for doing it, because so many people who have not been able to do it because it was only open for 18 months or thought, I can never afford that, put it in a box in the corner of their mind and thought, well, I'm not ever going to do that. It's unachievable. Mm. I got very, very lucky to be able to do it the way that I did it. So I'm very fortunate. But doing it that way, in that if you open up your calendar far enough out, and there's enough interest in, you know, we could put on a Sunday to Tuesday cruise and a Thursday to Saturday cruise. And then on Tuesday and Wednesday, we just have 3-hour slots with 50 people coming in, paying a couple of $100 each, and we can fill out that day there. But then if all of a sudden they open up the calendar and there's enough people who want to do the full cruise and it's 2 years out, book them into the cruise. If it's quieter and there's not as many people, which is, I guess, the issue that they had when they dropped the amount of cruises down, then open it up to, well, you're lucky, you're coming to Florida for 2 weeks, and on the second Tuesday, the ship's open and you can come in and do a tour of the ship and see everything, and it's a 3-hour experience and you sit down for lunch, and they've got more options then to make use of the space. And I think that way, not only would they make money in the immediate short term for that time slot, because you go to Galaxy's Edge, you only have 45 minutes at Ogre's. There's time limits on a lot of things.
Yeah.
They would then be teeing up people to come off that. And some would go, wow, well, I've seen it, I'm happy. And others would come off it going, I need to go back. You know, I want to do it.
I suppose the question is, like, the price point, is it? Do you offer some kind of, let's call it a Galaxy Far, Far Away experience ticket, which is Galaxy's Edge, and the price also includes the Halcyon experience. And let's say the uplift is, I don't know, an extra $80 or $100 or something like that. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, and I suppose that's the kind of thing that Disney would need to work out and figure out what is actually the price point they would need to do for someone like that to, A, continue to make money, but also to not put too many people off. If I was to fly out to the US and I want to spend, say, 2 or 3 weeks there, that means I've got to book a hotel for 2 or 3 weeks, and they either at the beginning or at the end or some point in the middle have a break so I can go to the house, you know, and stay there for a couple of days. So it kind of all becomes then a little bit more kind of complicated, doesn't it? You know, if you want to do it in one big hit, which is what a lot of my friends and people I was speaking about was like, oh yeah, we're going to do it, but we were going to do it as part of a bigger holiday rather than just go, you know, fly out specifically. Because as you know, as a well-traveled man who's been backwards and forwards to America, you know, the traveling there and back takes it out of you. And
it does.
You know, it does, yeah. The jet lag catches up, and it's, you know, it doesn't get any easier as you get older. So, you know, here's hoping that they bring it back. Maybe they reanimate it like they've reanimated those stormtroopers in the last episode of Ahsoka.
Hi, this is Samantha Aline, the first female stormtrooper in Star Wars, and you're listening to Fanfare Tracks.
At New York Comic Con, we had the good fortune to walk around a very, very busy artist alley, and in artist alley was a number of authors, including Charles Soule, who very, very kindly, considering he was very busy, gave us a few minutes to chat about his latest projects, most focused on his comics run for Marvel at the moment, which is absolutely fantastic. So this is myself and Charles Soule talking at the 2023 running of New York Comic Con.
So we're here at New York Comic Con. I'm here with Charles Soule.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well. Thanks for asking.
Enjoying the show, are you?
Oh, always. I am a New York native.
Yes.
I guess not technically. I've lived here for like 28 years, so pretty close, but I was born someplace else. But my point is, I've been coming to this show since it started, many, many, many years ago, and it's always a wild, super intense ride, but you get to meet so many people. So many people come in from other places, like yourselves, for example, and this year in particular has been great because there's been so much love for not just my work in Star Wars, but a lot of other work I've been doing lately, so it feels very, it's felt really good this year.
When you do a project, when you roll something new out, be it Star Wars or anything else, how much, vindication is not the right word, but how much enjoyment do you get from seeing the reception that it gets with your audience?
Oh, it's phenomenal. I mean, whether it's, were you guys at either of the, or any of the celebrations lately? Or okay, so you know, the High Republic panels, there was the last one in London, and then the one before that in Anaheim. And particularly that first one in Anaheim, we brought out the High Republic. And when I say we, I mean, you know, me and Amy, Claudia Gray and Justin Ireland and, you know, the crew, Daniel, Kevin. And we were in this huge panel room with like 4,000 people in it, and we had never, we had only experienced the High Republic through a screen, online, social media, reviews, that sort of thing. So to be in a room with that many people in it, that big, and the roar from them when we came out, because they were getting to express their appreciation communally for this thing that we had made, it really felt like the doors had blown open to understanding what we had done. And that remains one of my favorite moments of my entire career, was that first panel at Anaheim.
The High Republic has a vociferous following.
Yes.
A really strong following. Was that something you anticipated when you guys started Project Luminous? Or
no,
did it kind
no.
of just...
you know, because you can't, it is impossible to say for sure the fans will be there. I know we did it. It's never like that. And if, I mean, I think there are certain people who are like that, but that's not how we were, especially since it was brand new. Star Wars is not always, entirely receptive to new things. Yeah. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not, and it's a bit of a dice roll. All we knew was that we were all giving it our A game, and we loved what we had done, and it felt like pure, real, the good stuff is what we felt about it. But we didn't know until we put it into the world. Those first reviews started to come in, and then again, the real, you know, wallop, the underscoring was that panel in Anaheim.
A lot of the watching you do, especially for Star Wars, is very, very collaborative. Obviously, High Republic, obviously the stuff for Marvel. Do you enjoy that? I spoke to Ethan Sachs recently for Insider, and he said how there's a whole team of you working together, and you're kind of helping steer the plot ship, if you like. Is that something you get as much fun and enjoyment out of, seeding these things, as writing your own stuff?
Yes, I mean, I am one of those guys who likes big picture storytelling.
Yeah.
So, it is fun for me to think that we're telling this big story that has a bunch of different pieces that all are sort of thematically connected and connected in a story way. This is kind of the dream from when you're a little kid, like getting to know really big canvas stories in the Star Wars universe, whether it's the High Republic, whether it's something like Crimson Rain or Dark Droids, whether it's just writing the journey of Luke Skywalker between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. Like, these are the dream jobs, and I've been very fortunate to have quite a few of them.
And it's interesting, obviously, the Marvel comics, you look back on X-Men back in the day, and there was Fall of the Mutants, Mutant Massacre. There's moments, there's stories, there's crossovers, Secret Wars. You come to Star Wars, it's still a Marvel comic, so it feels like there's these moments, Dark Droids, Hidden Empire. Again, that must be satisfying as a comic writer as well as a Star Wars writer.
It is. I feel incredibly fortunate to be working in this zone that I love at all, much less working on it at the level that I am, getting to tell stories that have real meaning and impact within the fandom as well as the Star Wars timeline. Like, I've gotten to tell some really great beats that I would have never, 12-year-old me, that's the cliche, right? 12-year-old me would never have expected any of this to happen. So I just, fingers crossed, we'll keep getting the opportunity to tell more stories. And, you know, I think as long as folks keep responding, I will.
And final question, because you've got a queue building up. Dark Droids, we're in the midst of it now.
Yep.
It's just really starting to roll out. And we're on the run-up to Return of the Jedi. We're still not quite at that point. It's been a fascinating ride from Empire to Jedi. You mentioned, obviously, 12-year-old you would have been mind-blown to think you could do that. How enjoyable is adult Charles found this to do this run of stories?
It's also, I mean, it's just as enjoyable, I think. It's different. That would have been, I don't know that 12-year-old me would have done as good a job as me now, but I think it's wonderful. These are characters that I have loved. These characters are very real to me in a way that I think they are to many Star Wars fans. So I want to treat them with love and care, not make sure only good things happen to them, because that's not realistic. But really, like, how Luke went from that guy with his hand cut off at the end of Empire to the person we saw at the beginning of Return of the Jedi, that's a question I want to see answered as a fan. And so if I'm going to be the one who tells that story, which I seem to be, I don't want to make it any less than what I would have wanted to see when I was that 12-year-old boy who just walked out of Empire with his mind blown. So, you know, it's a true privilege. I am thrilled that I get the opportunity. And as I said, I hope that people keep responding to the stories and Lucasfilm keeps enjoying my work and I get to keep doing more.
Well, keep it up. We'd love to read it. It's a Georgia review as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yep.
So, Kelsey Grammer, he's best known for playing Fraser Crane in Cheers and Fraser, and Fraser has returned after 18 years on Paramount Plus as a streaming series. But the news came out this week via the Graham Bensinger podcast that Kelsey Grammer once auditioned for a role in Star Wars, and it turns out that the role he auditioned for was Han Solo, and he didn't know that was the role he'd auditioned for until about 18 months later, when he goes to see Star Wars and suddenly realises, oh crap, this is the film I auditioned for and didn't get. But, and this is a real way out there question mark, could you imagine Star Wars, specifically Han Solo, played by the guy behind Fraser Crane?
No. I mean, I watch a lot of Fraser. It's on like every day on Channel 4. I have watched the new series on Paramount Plus. Reaction chat not coming anytime soon, people. However, yeah, I just don't know. if there's ever anybody who's associated with one character and one character only, pretty much it's got to be Kelsey Grammer as Fraser Crane. So it's very difficult because that's such a cerebral character, and that kind of show is quite an old kind of vintage kind of like comedy farce that you don't get so much these days. You know, it's kind of like lost to the sands of time and stuff. Other than obviously Sideshow Bob, I don't ever think I've seen Kelsey Grammer in anything where he's played like a serious role as such. I mean, obviously he's played Beast in X-Men. I suppose if you cast Kelsey Grammer as Han Solo, then you've got to cast David Hyde Pierce,
yeah.
As C-3PO, surely. I mean, really, actually, those two should just be R2 and 3PO. That would make it, I mean, I'd watch it any day of the week.
From memory, I think when they were casting Star Wars, they were also casting Carrie. And so
that's right,
De Palma and Lucas were kind of seeing all these young kids, and it wasn't so much whether this guy was great for Luke or Han or Leia. It was the mixture of the actors and how they bounced off each other. So if you had cast Kelsey Grammer as Han Solo, you would not have cast Mark Hamill as Luke Skywalker. You probably wouldn't have cast Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia. You would have had other actors. That's the classic what-if scenario. They probably definitely made the right decision, because if he had been Han Solo, then he wouldn't have been Fraser Crane and would have missed out on all that great television. So things happen for a reason. And if you watch the clip, there's no real regret. I mean, everybody would love a Star Wars in their career, but I think having Star Wars in your career is the tip of the iceberg and all the iceberg that you don't see all wrapped into one. It's huge. It would have been very interesting to see Kelsey Grammer as Han Solo. I'd love to see him in Star Wars, though, in the future.
Oh, undoubtedly. Yeah, I mean, you could see him in like The Mandalorian or something like that, or, you know, that. It's not a stretch to kind of say, oh, he wouldn't fit. But it's always, it's difficult. I mean, you know, we had this with The Mandalorian this season when you plonk Jack Black and Lizzo, yeah. The casting really needs to be on point. Otherwise, you just go, it's just Jack Black in Star Wars. And no disrespect to Jack Black. A bit like Roger Moore, really. He can play any character because he's just playing himself, and that's what Jack Black kind of does. It's kind of like, you know, it doesn't matter if he's in Star Wars, Star Trek, or Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it's still going to be Jack Black playing Jack Black. It's interesting what you say, because if you think about it, it's quite prescient that you brought this up, because like when you think about the casting, like the big thing about Star Wars was the fact that it was this, as people refer to it over the decades, this, it was lightning in the bottle. It was the right time, the right cast, and the right perfect alchemy mix that just made it an absolute mind-shatteringly influential. And we've seen it, whether or not directly or indirectly, people have tried to almost manufacture that kind of lightning in the bottle, and it's not worked. And so you kind of think to yourself, well, okay, it's worked then, but why wouldn't it not work with a reboot for Star Wars? Or why would it not work if we were to recast the original actors? Which I believe is something that Matthew Vaughn, the director of Kick-Ass, was speaking about earlier on this week.
He was. And it's an interesting piece and seamless link, by the way, Mark. He actually says, you know, if he was offered a Star Wars film to direct, he's like, nah, not so much for me. Doing a Star Wars movie is to play with the characters that I love. So if they said they'd reboot Star Wars and have Luke Skywalker, Solo, and Vader and do your version of it, everyone would say you're an idiot to try, but that would excite me. And then he goes on to say, why are the Star Wars characters so hallowed that from 1977 you can't redo it for a new audience? And he compares it then to other franchises. And of course, knowing that you're a James Bond fan, he kind of compares it to Bond by saying, you know, they've rebooted Bond and they reboot superhero movies. Why can't you reboot Star Wars? I have my thoughts. I mean, one of the things that he says is that, you know, Star Wars needs right now an epic new film. And there is no doubt that Star Wars really does right now on the big screen need an epic new movie. His shortcut, I would say, is to just reboot the original and remake it. But when you're with a franchise that's so deep and so lore-driven and so beloved, the only thing I think compares to Star Wars in that respect is the original cast of Star Trek. They're the only two that I can think are on that level. Mm. What do you think? I mean, do you think it'll ever happen? People have said this in the past, oh, Zac Efron as Luke Skywalker and so on and so forth. But going back to that point we made a minute ago of Lucas found the alchemy of the right actors to make Han, Luke and Leia pop off the page with the added magic that Hamill and Fisher, who's would have been 67 this week, and Harrison Ford brought to the roles. Do you think that's ever going to happen?
Oh man, that is a really tough question, because I think, I mean, part of really what made Star Wars work was the contrast of, you know, what was going on in the world at the time in the 70s, just kind of coming out of Vietnam War. You had the rise of the independent filmmaker and some very heavy going, nitty gritty kind of films like, you know, Easy Rider and stuff like that, and Taxi Driver, and all that weighs into it as much. Like, the original, you know, films are still watched time and time again by people. Like, the franchise is there. I think the problem is that they don't quite know what to do with it. And I think probably part of it is actually they are burdened by the weight of 40 plus years of lore and nostalgia that's gone with it. I mean, hell, the whole of The Force Awakens marketing was basically based around nostalgia on one level or another. And that obviously is causing issues. And I think it is. It's making it harder for people to accept new characters. Star Wars is, to be honest, I think the characters are still well beloved and I think the actors are still beloved. If you were to reboot Star Wars, it would just be a comparison. I think everybody would comparison beat for beat. And if you were to just do a remake of A New Hope, will fall flat on its ass because people will just be comparing it too much to the original. I think you almost recast the characters, but you do a continuation. What happened after Return of Jedi or in between Empire and Jedi or something like that, you know, which of course is covered in the comics. So it suddenly starts to get very messy unless you do a complete clean reboot, which is that's a big thing to do.
I think you could recast certain actors, but when you look at that original film, it is the words you use, it's the alchemy of getting those actors together that makes the magic work, the wit and the attitude and the everything. There's so much in the subtext of Star Wars, there's so much that we kind of read into it as kids,
yeah,
that almost became fact but wasn't. But nevertheless, it's all about feel and vibe and tone, and those actors set the tone and all the other performers bounced off the lead three actors. Of course, off Alec Guinness and Peter Cushing and other factors, but they're the core of it. So I think you can recast certain actors. There's no way you're going to get away with recasting, for example, Han, Luke and Leia. You could recast Han or Luke or Leia. You're not going to have the same magic with those three new actors together that you had with the original three. My point is, I don't think after 47, nearly 48 years, that you can reboot Star Wars. Because one, the only way to reboot Star Wars is to just take those characters and tell a completely different story. Because where do you go after you've rebooted A New Hope? Hey, you reboot Empire Strikes Back. How did that work out for Star Trek Into Darkness when they kind of tried to reboot Wrath of Khan? It didn't.
Exactly.
So I don't think it's doable. I think it's also Matthew Vaughn being a little bit mischievous. He's a smart man. He's directed some big films. He's worked in franchises. He knows you can't reboot Star Wars. I think he's just saying, if it was me and I had the ultimate decision and I could make a Star Wars film, hey, I want to remake A New Hope with Luke and Han and Vader and Leia and all the other characters I loved as a kid, and that's what I'd like to do. I'd find that exciting. Yeah, that ain't going to happen, Matthew. I don't think he's being serious. I think he's being kind of mischievous.
I don't think there's any desire, is there, really, to kind of go down this route for Lucasfilm. They would have done it, and I think if they wanted to do it, they could have just done it back in 2015 and just gone, do you know what? It's kind of is a reboot. It kind of isn't at the same time.
I think the nearest you'll ever get to reboots is that era. It's Force Awakens, which felt like a soft reboot.
Yeah.
And Galaxy of Adventures, which retold a lot of the original episodes. And I'd love to see that art style back again. I thought Galaxy of Adventures was beautiful to watch. That kind of refreshed and gave a little tweak to certain things.
Yeah, a little tweak.
But that was a stylistic decision. There were stylistic choices in that that didn't necessarily completely adapt what we saw in the films, because the films are immutable and they don't change unless George decides to do a special edition. But, you know, hey-ho, that's a totally different podcast. I think Matthew Vaughn was being a little bit mischievous here, but it does make you think that all those years of continuity, and I know you've got canon and legends and all that other stuff, but so much of legends now folds back into the canon. It's what Matt Martin said. Don't think this has all gone away forever.
Yeah,
we're going to cherry pick the cool stuff. And they really have over the years. I think it shows, discussing it, the strength of Star Wars in that it's got this ongoing story, this ongoing galaxy as a location that you can hop around the timeline and just tell amazing stories.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
Readers of FanthaTracks will have seen an announcement regarding Yub-Nub, The Forgotten Ewok Adventures. It's a Kickstarter that's being led by a young documentary filmmaker called Tom Grove, and Eric Walker, the original mate from Caravan of Courage and Battle for Endor. There are background scenes that have never been seen. There's all kinds of information that will be folded into this documentary. The Kickstarter's running now. You'll find the article up on FanthaTracks. And a couple of weeks ago, I had the good fortune to talk to Tom about the project. So this is myself and Tom Groves talking all about Yub Nub, the Forgotten Ewok Adventures.
So, Tom, tell us a little bit about this project, because it's fascinating. It's a project that people will have known of for years and years, a topic that people are aware of. But how did you kind of find your way to this subject?
The first thing was that I go to an event every year, London Film and Comic Con, and Eric Walker, who was in these two Ewok movies, was set to appear, do photo shoots, signings and talks and things like that. I'd just come off of a documentary I made called The Legend of King Kong, which just recently won Best Documentary. Out of the blue, I just sent Eric Walker a message sort of saying, I'm coming to this event, any chance I can follow you about and just film you doing your Comic-Con stuff. It kind of evolved from there, and it's come into a more of a piece about why these two Ewok films, what I've recently put on Disney Plus, have become forgotten.
What do you think the reason for that is? Of course, we know all about canon and not canon. And given that especially Caravan came out the year after Jedi, so hype for Star Wars was huge. Why do you think it is that they've slid a little bit by the wayside? And on the flip side of that, why do you think it is that people are now showing such a good interest in it?
People are showing interest in it now because they've just added them to Disney Plus, and now they're just finding them. And now they're sort of like, whoa, what's this? Like, they've never heard or seen of these films before. And to be honest, they're not like the greatest films ever made. So then people can joke about with them. But surprisingly, when they first came out, these films on TV, they won award, like TV awards. They were well received at the time. And obviously over time, now they've just become forgotten. It's a really weird situation. But that's what I want to explore with this film I'm making, is like the reason why they've been forgotten. Because like you just mentioned, Caravan of Courage came out just after Return of the Jedi. Obviously, Return of the Jedi is sort of like such a pop culture film, but then Caravan of Courage isn't. That's all I'm trying to find.
Now that you're going into this, and presumably you're learning plenty about Caravan and Battle for Endor, but specifically Caravan, let's start off with, what have you learnt about that project and the film? And you mentioned the reception to it, which was, as you say, at the time, you know, it won awards. It had 65 million people, I think, watched it on ABC when it first was screened. It was hugely popular. What have you learnt about the film that made you go, actually, I didn't expect that, or I didn't know that?
How much care was put into it? Because looking from the outside, it sort of felt to me over the years in the same category as the Star Wars Holiday Special. And we all know how that turned out. Researching on both these films and talking to the cast and crew of both films, you can feel the love and affection that was actually put into them. And then once you find all this information, and once the documentary is made, you watch my documentary, and then you go watch the films, you have the appreciation of there's so much detail and care put into them. Like all the stop motion creatures and all the creature suits that are used in them, they're just so well made. But unfortunately, they get lumped into the holiday special because of the sort of TV factor and the fact that they're not really fondly remembered like others.
When you spoke to Eric, he's got great recollections of making Caravan, not so much Battle because he was only in it briefly, but Caravan especially. When you started to learn things like, for example, George Lucas directed scenes on Caravan of Courage, some of the second unit and pickups and stuff, was that a surprise to you? Because when Phantom Menace came out, it was very much, this is George's first directing role since A New Hope. And then you suddenly actually, in retrospect, realise, actually, no, he did this stuff on Caravan and filmed it at the ranch. So there's quite an interesting history to the film that a lot of people won't know, isn't there?
That's something I'd really like to show in this documentary, is because I've been given access to never before seen like behind the scenes footage and pictures of both films. And there's quite a bit of footage of Eric Walker and George Lucas when he's filming the reshoots of the film. And there's this really good picture of George Lucas directing Eric. There's a fantastic picture of George Lucas talking to Eric with George's hand sort of up and sort of like doing the like director thing with his hands. And it's just like, wow. And when I interviewed Eric, he has such fond memories of working with George Lucas.
I know he got confused a lot for a younger Mark Hamill because there is quite there's quite a similarity, isn't there, back then?
Yeah.
And of course, being the original Mace, Eric has very much been the flag bearer for that particular film.
When I was with him in London Comic Con, every autograph he signed was Eric Walker, first Mace, on every autograph he put on everything. I want to know why George Lucas decided to name, I see, Sam Jackson Mace as well. Was he sort of trying to forget the Ewok a little bit, or was it just sort of a coincidence sort of thing?
I think, from what I know, one of the early drafts of the original film had a character called Mace Windy. Mace Tawani was named after that Mace, but of course, when you get to the prequel trilogy, it's a different level because it's cinematic and stuff. So I think that's where Mace Windu came from. But I guess it's one of those names. I always think there's probably every other guy in the galaxy is called Bobber, because Bobber's probably like being called John Smith or something. So it's just one of those common names. Because it's such a sort of a sweet film, and it's a kid's film, you know, with the two Mace and Sindel at the heart of it. Do you think if that film was made now with better access to visual effects and the volume and all the other stuff, do you think a story like Cameron and Courage would still work in 2023 in the way that it did in 1984?
I don't know. That's a hard question, because the state of cinema has changed so much since the 80s and 90s. What you can regard as like a good kid's film or an actual blockbuster film has changed so much. Because, I mean, the state of blockbusters nowadays, every superhero film wants to be the blockbuster, but superhero films are made just to be a blockbuster, not made to be an actual film. Things like Jaws and Star Wars were just films that were made or just happened to become a blockbuster. I mean, they sort of invented the term blockbuster. Having a film like Caravan of Courage come out now, I'd feel it'd be the same fate as it was originally. Obviously, when it came out, it was straight to TV. In some areas, went to cinemas, but if it was out now, it would go straight to streaming. It would have some sort of hype to it or level of excitement to it, I suppose, but I doubt it would actually break any records or get that many people around it. But I think the charm of it is that it's of its time, and you can look back through the lens and be like, wow, they actually made something of nothing.
I'm old enough to have seen it at the cinema when it came out. Obviously, we got it here in Scotland on cinema and Battle for Endor, but I never saw Battle for Endor at the cinema. I don't know why, but definitely saw Caravan quite a few times. We didn't think we were going to get anything after Jedi. It was very much the end of the road, so anything was a bonus. And then BBC One started showing Ewoks and droids, well, certainly droids, and then it fizzled for a while. In your research for Caravan and for Battle, and also just as an offshoot that just drops into my head, I interviewed Eric on stage at London Film and Comic Con, so it's quite fortunate.
Oh, yes.
And he did mention that there was somewhere in Lucasfilm archives, there is a script for a third film. I've often wondered what that would have been, how they would have took the story further on, given the nature of the two films. Where do you think they might have taken it?
I don't know. Recently, obviously working on this, I rewatched both films multiple times. And what they did with the second film was a bit harsh on the original actors. Sort of, they kind of politely pushed them out, killed them off, and it was just only the little girl, Sindel, Aubrey Miller, who was left, and it sort of pushed sort of Eric and everyone else out. But Battle for Endor, it's a weird film because it's nothing like Caravan of Courage. And the way it ends, it tries to be sort of the Endor battle from Return of the Jedi, just sort of like trying sort of action, sort of try and have it a big thing. But then for a third one, I know they've got like something somewhere in an archive, but I have no idea what they could do with it. Because I think those two Ewok films, they're both fine because one's a proper kid-friendly film, nothing in it at all. The second one is more of the Ewoks fighting people, like in Return of the Jedi. And then I don't know if Disney or Lucasfilm or anyone would really want another Ewok film that sort of explores something else. I know, because I think in that the video game, Star Wars Battlefront 2, that there was a Ewok hunt, stormtroopers sort of fighting the Ewoks, like a horror-style thing. I interviewed Kevin Thompson for this documentary, and he said the same exact thing. He would want something to do with the Ewoks where they're just feral. They just go and attack the stormtroopers, like, really, like, violently. He wanted to see them sort of be proper sort of animals. But, I mean, that'd be quite funny to see, but I doubt we'll get it.
They're the original murder bears, aren't they? I mean, they are preparing a barbecue for Han Solo, let's not forget.
Yeah.
It's always kind of been there. And this is the old classic, isn't it? Where did they get Princess Leia's dress from? Clearly somebody at some point turned up before and ended up as a snack. With your research then looking into the two films, and obviously the modern era of Disney Star Wars and cinematic Star Wars, let's say over the last sort of 8-9 years since Force Awakens, has brought us a very different arena for Star Wars to be told in. But looking back to 83, 84, 85, 86, that kind of era when these films were being made and then released, what have you sort of learned from that time period? Because Star Wars was clearly the biggest dog in the yard in terms of IP and franchises, not that people thought of it in those terms.
Doing anything Star Wars nowadays is tricky because every aspect of ILM, Lucasfilm and Disney has been documented somewhere by someone. But then that's the reason why I thought about the Ewok films. People know they exist. They've either seen them or they haven't, or they hate them or they love them. But then there hasn't been a specific thing about them in my recollection. There hasn't been a book or a film talking about the making of them. To sort of go out of that slightly, you said about Star Wars being such a big thing in the 80s and 90s and everything, but then this is my own personal opinion, but that's when Star Wars was like at its peak. That's when it was like perfect. But then nowadays it's sort of hit and miss.
There's so much of it now. I think that's the thing that always strikes me looking back when I was a kid, and you had the comics every week, your Palitoy figures, and your read-along adventures, be it cassette or little 7-inch vinyl. Star Wars wasn't even on television until late 1982. So there was such a scarcity of Star Wars, and the Ewok series or cartoon series and droids and the Ewok movies very much kind of fell into the very back of that time period. Yeah. So I think there's a definitely a great affection for them. Who have you managed to speak to in relation to the two films in your documentary?
I've only interviewed Eric Walker and Kevin Thompson. He played various Ewoks, and he's a stuntman in both films, and he was in Return of the Jedi. Those are the only two guys I've interviewed so far. I've interviewed them just before the Kickstarter. And when this Kickstarter starts to raise funds to pay for things for the documentary, that's when the rest of the interviews will be sort of gearing up.
And tell us a little bit about the project and about the Kickstarter. What are your goals? What are your aims for this?
Well, for anything regarding film, is sort of, if you got no money, you got no film. So it's sort of like in the backseat, sort of going, asking people, please give us your money, politely. But I'm still debating between two or three different sort of price goals on the Kickstarter. I'm just awaiting upon the poster by Mark Lamming. He's worked for like Marvel on like Darth Vader and Dr. Aphra and various other Star Wars comic books. But he's doing this fantastic cover art.
That sounds fantastic.
I mean, it's been so good speaking to you, because this is like something as a passion project for me, because it's sort of like Star Wars is one of those things. I mean, like yourself and so many other people that you grew up watching, and then you manage to work on something which is Star Wars, and you sort of pinch yourself sort of thing. I'm working on something Star Wars, and it's always it's a great honor that you're actually doing something Star Wars.
Celebrate the love, as they said at the end of Jedi. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Ethan Sachs, writer of Bounty Hunters, and you're listening to Fanthatrax.
We have a listener's question. It is from Skyhawker, a regular questionnaire, and the question is, hi dudes, the Ahsoka series is now finished, and I've listened to your views on the episodes each week. For me, I thought the series as a whole was fine/okay. Not as good as Mando Seasons 1 and 2, but better than Book of Boba Fett. Although I've been a Star Wars fan since the original film, I've always struggled with the various animated shows. I've watched them all, including Rebels and Clone Wars, but they barely held my attention. Do you think the Ahsoka series relied too heavily on the audience being fully versed on the animated series? And if so, is this perhaps why people like myself have only liked it rather than loved it? And again, that's from Skyhawker. So, very relevant question. And I'll throw it straight to you. Do you think you needed to have seen Clone Wars and specifically Rebels to really get the full effect of what they were going for in Ahsoka?
Well, firstly, thank you, Mr. Paul Andrews, for that lovely question. I watched all of Ahsoka at least once, sat next to my lovely partner, Karen, who through me and just through kind of like osmosis knew a little bit about Rebels and Clone Wars. She never really watched it. I mean, she knew who like Ahsoka was and stuff like that. There was a few points where we had to kind of pause and I explained a couple of things, but I don't necessarily think that she felt like she missed much. Some of the things that was missing from Ahsoka, whilst it was to do with the characters, I think it was more lacking in chemistry between some of the actors. It felt a bit flat. And I think also they either did take a certain level of assumption that everybody had a rough idea who everybody was. But it's difficult because both me and you have watched all these series. I admit I have only watched Clone Wars and Rebels maybe the full kind of like run of both of those maybe twice. And so I'm pretty sure I missed a few things. But it's very hard to kind of stand to one side and go, well, you know, if I hadn't seen any of that, I wouldn't have a foggiest. They left enough in the show that you got a hint, but it felt very much like it didn't really go anywhere, if I'm honest. That's for me what it felt like. It felt like we only really got half a season. I mean, I liked the pacing and I liked everything about Ahsoka. I just wondered if, like, maybe, you know, we could have done with at least another two, maybe four episodes to really ramp things up. In the grand scheme of things, Dave Filoni's got two or three seasons in his head, and there's a kind of a pacing going on that when we see the final episode of Ahsoka, whenever that is, we kind of go, okay, well, that is amazing and that all makes sense, and all our criticisms are, we take it all back because it's worked out perfectly. But obviously we don't know what's going on. There's not been any indication that there is a second season, so therefore we've kind of been left with this kind of like weird ending whereby we've got a couple of main characters in a galaxy and then a big baddie now in the new galaxy without really knowing what's next. It's a weird place to be. I mean, it's one thing to kind of wrap up a whole like trilogy of films like the end of Return of Jedi and go, right, well, we don't know what's next. Is there, we hope there's going to be more Star Wars. But for it to kind of get to the end of like the Ahsoka series as it has, and it not really feel like there was any conclusion or indication of what we're going to get next, that's what's been bothering me more than anything. But what about you?
On that final point, I definitely agree with that. I think the difference between Ahsoka and, let's say, Andor is that we always knew there was two seasons of Andor. We get to Rick's Road, which was still one of the finest episodes of television I've ever seen, and we knew that we would get some continuation to a large degree and resolution to a smaller degree in the first season, episode of season two, and we would get things picked up. We'd know where it had moved on to, and we knew, if not specifically when, but we knew that it was coming, and we still do. Regardless of the actor strikes and the writer strikes and stuff, we know that season two's nearly in the can, and you know we're going to get it, if not next year, then probably 2025. My point is that that is something that is definitely on the way. With Ahsoka, it's not. We don't know when we're going to get. We don't know if we're going to get a season two of Ahsoka. We don't know if these stories are going to be wrapped up in, let's throw our minds back a couple of 3 years to season two of Mandalorian. We never expected the conclusion or the follow-on from that final episode of season two to happen in the Book of Boba Fett. So with Ahsoka, we're assuming that it will be picked up in the film or in the next season of Ahsoka. Hey, we might have two episodes of Skeleton Crew that tell you what happens next in Ahsoka. We just don't know. That we can't guess yet. Yeah. There's no, and I think that's where a lot of the uncertainty comes from. When's this going to happen? But going back to Skywalker's point, I think when they started the show, I think Lucasfilm and Disney were quite smart in sort of saying, no, you don't need to have watched all this stuff. We're not expecting you to go and watch seven seasons of Clone Wars and four seasons of Rebels. No, you don't need to do that. I think it became pretty evident fairly quickly that you kind of needed at least a primer. And when you got to the end of it, that final scene with Baylan standing on the Mortis God statue on Peridia, that meant something if you'd watched the Mortis arc of the Clone Wars. If you hadn't, you'd be like, that's a cool statue. And it doesn't affect the moment, really, but if you've got more knowledge and depth, and I'm like you, I saw most episodes of Clone Wars once. I enjoyed the show very much. Rebels, the same. Watched them, enjoyed them, got a lot out of it, but not a show that I ever went back and rewatched and rewatched and rewatched. And also, I think because doing sites like we do and doing the pods that we do, if there's information I don't know and I don't beat myself up for not knowing every detail of every episode of every show that's ever been on, because there's just too much Star Wars now, I know where to go and find that information. So I don't worry about if I don't know something now, whereas 10, 15 years ago, it would have bugged me if I didn't know it. You just can't hold all that information in your head. They should have primed people a little bit better. I think a good editor with a bit of knowledge could have pulled together a package that would have primed casual viewers, even people like us, who a refresher would not have hurt. Oh, yeah, I remember that in Rebels. Oh, you know, when they pull Mother Talzin, you know, the Talzin sword out of thin air, and I completely forgot that was in an episode of The Clone Wars, and things like that. You know, it's like, wow, yeah, of course. We've seen this blade before. Little things like that. That's why I think, and maybe the writer's strike and the actor's strike has affected the fact that at the moment we're not having it this week in Star Wars. very much miss those kind of shows being on Lucasfilm.com and StarWars.com and out there on YouTube. I think they would be really helpful, that they could have just given you a little bit of, hey, don't forget, kids, you saw this in. And they do things on the site. There are articles that look back on the episodes on the site, but it's all in retrospect, which kind of makes sense. They don't want to spoil too much, but I just think they could have done a bit of a better job of priming it, but I get why they didn't. That's not a big selling point. Yeah, you probably should watch everything we've done before because this show is lore heavy, but if you don't, you'll kind of still get it.
I think, to Skywalker's point, no one should be watching an episode of Star Wars on Disney Plus and then have to go and then watch a 75 things that you've missed in the last episode of Ahsoka, or with all due respect to them, or as much as they're great, like Star Wars Explained kind of videos, which are great because they delve deep into it. But like, I don't think you should be doing that. I think they should be there for those who want to maybe understand things a little bit more. And I think the end shot is probably sums it up best than ever. To somebody who has not watched Clone Wars, it means absolutely sweet FA. Absolutely nothing. There was not enough of Baylan's story in this first season for anybody to get a idea of what he was doing there. And even somebody like myself don't really have a rough idea of what he's trying to do, because you try and connect that to Mortis and you think, well, Mortis, we were always told, was slightly abstract, and was it a dream, was it not? And it was all left really vague. We are in a franchise that has basically tried to continue a continuous storyline for 40 plus years. Dave could have chucked in a load of stuff from a Marvel's, you know, original comic. And then it's like, oh, are we expected to now go back and reread all the vintage Marvel comics because that might just slip in something from that? It does become a bit of a burden on the fan, especially the either more casual fan or the newer fan, I mean, to then have to try and get into all this and then learn all this stuff. And I think it makes it difficult. It almost becomes a bit of a hurdle. And I also wonder if it's slightly bad storytelling and scripting for doing it. You don't want characters to have to do a ton of exposition. And I think where they kind of handled it relatively well was maybe with the Kanan Jarrus references. I think there was just enough to kind of get an idea of that there was this Jedi called Kanan Jarrus and he was Ezra's master. But like, who the hell is Ezra Bridger anyway in the first place? And I mean, I don't really think they ever explained fully how him and Thrawn got into the Peridian Galaxy anyway. For somebody who has never watched Star Wars Rebels, I think you'd be like, how the hell has this dude ended up there? It doesn't make a lot of sense. But then, like I said, you end up having loads of people just stood around explaining stuff, which in itself doesn't make for very good and interesting Star Wars viewing. Righty, that is all we have got time for this week. It's been a little bit longer episode, but you've missed us and we've missed you, so we figured a little bit longer of me and Mark was not necessarily a bad thing. You may disagree, and if you disagree, or if you have a listener's question like Mr. Skywalker had, then you can send it in. And Mark has all the information and details how you can do it.
Yes, I do. If you want to be a part of the action, visit FanthaTracks.com and be sure to comment, like and share on our social media feeds at FanthaTracks. Send in those listeners' questions by emailing radio@FanthaTracks.com. Subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Semple for composing the FanthaTracks intro, Adam O'Brien for our Making Tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Tune in to Good Morning Tatooine. It's live Sunday evenings at 9 o'clock UK, 4 p.m. Eastern and 1 p.m. Pacific on Facebook, YouTube and Twitch. And check out our FanthaTracks Radio Friday night rotation. It's every Friday night, 7 o'clock UK time, for new episodes of The Phantom from Down Under, Planet Layer, Desert Planet Disc, Start Your Engines, Collecting Tracks, Cannon Fodder, and special episodes of Making Tracks. And every Tuesday at 7 o'clock UK time for your weekly episode of Making Tracks. And remember, FanthaTracks.com, our social media feeds, FanthaTracks TV, and FanthaTracks Radio are absolutely
free.
Free? So no Patreon, Buy Me A Coffee, Kickstarter or Indiegogo required to stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news. And that's me done for this bumper episode.
Thank you very much for listening, everybody. So we will catch you on the bounce next week. So until then, have a fantastic Star Wars week, whatever that means to you. And of course, as always, may the Force be with you.
Coming up next on FanthaTracks Radio, it's another episode of Making Tracks.